on the Korean Peninsula after the summit. The leaders of the two Koreas, Moon Jae-in of South Korea and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, issued a joint statement saying that they would vow to end the Korean War.
As you know, I will soon be meeting with Kim Jong-un as we seek a future of peace, harmony, and security for the whole Korean Peninsula, and in fact, for the whole world.
The fact that the whole world came together and said to North Korea, no.
That's why we must have a fair and reciprocal trading relationship with our friends and partners.
Merkel did say, though, that she believes there is a pathway forward potentially for a bilateral trade deal between the EU and the United States.
Very matter of fact they were today. It wasn't like Macron with all the lovey-dovey stuff.
A lot of things are happening that were never going to happen before.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Just when you thought the yield curve was going to invert, interest rates went in the opposite direction, as yields on 10-year bonds this week rose above 3%. Markets having a hard time digesting that. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in the first hour will be John Roque. He's a market strategist. He sees some risk ahead, and especially what could happen with interest rates. He's taking a look, and we'll be sharing some charts with you and comparisons when we take a look at the markets today compared to the markets in the heyday of the tech bubble. Also joining me later on in the program will be Dr. Ellen Wald. She's author of the book Saudi Inc. She's a Middle East expert as we take a look at Aramco's IPO. If it goes as they want it to, it'll be the most expensive IPO listed in history with a value of $2 trillion. Is that realistic? Well, we're going to find out why. And also joining me in the first hour, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler, and contrary to normal custom, in the second hour, Jim Poplava and I are going to run away as Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava take over the anchor seats here and examine Financial Sense's quarterly outlook. It's time for an examination of the Financial Sense indicators, for monetary issues to the leading economic indicators to financial stress and forecasters of recession. All of those things coming up in the second hour of the program on the Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And starting off the show today, welcome back Ryan Poplava to talk about the catalysts and drivers this week on, of all places, who would have thought, Wall Street. It seemed like things stabilized somewhat for stocks this week. But I will say, Ryan, there was one day on Wednesday when the S&P 500 was down almost 2%. But the stocks came back on earnings the following day. So was this week all about earnings, or were there some inflationary fears lurking around there like they were last week?
Yeah, John, this week was a mixed bag. It was definitely a busy week with more than about a third of the S&P 500 companies reporting. Caterpillar was really one that was in focus in a big way because we look at them as a bellwether on global activity. They posted an earnings beat, and they did really well there. The stock was up initially, but as soon as they started talking about the conference call, the president and CFO Brad Halverson really painted a picture that a lot of investors focused in on, that they weren't real happy about with what he was implying. Basically, he said, and I wanted to find a sound clip for you, I couldn't, so you'll have to just deal with the transcript here. He basically said that while we expect strong operating margins for the rest of the year, which is defined as within our better than the investor day ranges, we do not expect to repeat first quarter operating margin at the consolidated level. Their outlook assumes that the first quarter adjusted profit per share will be the high water mark for the year. Soon as he said that, high water mark, I was hearing that across a number of different trading desks and a number of different articles being written about it. This was a big concern. And then coupled with that wording there, that this was the high water mark for the year, that the profit margins are peaking here, we heard from United Technology, 3M and Lockheed, who also saw investors pulling back from earnings responses there. So it was a very bad day for industrials on Tuesday, and that caused the whole sector to finish down, I think, 3.2% for the week. This seems to be a theme we are starting to see economically, which my brother Chris has been sharing some thoughts on with our clients, with our quarterly newsletter, talking about some anticipatory indicators looking like they're rolling over. And looking at, I was discussing it with him this week, he was sharing with me some of the thoughts he's had with some of our other very distinguished strategists that we've had on the show here, that they're seeing the same exact thing. Some of these anticipatory indicators are starting to roll over. A little bit of a concern that we may have seen the peak, maybe in earnings, maybe a peak in the growth rate, essentially the growth rate, not necessarily, you know, if we slow down, if we're still growing at a slower rate, the market gets concerned about that. And we sometimes see corrections possibly even leading towards recessions. So anyways, that was a big thing we've been talking about a lot this week. That also is a main reason why some of our portfolios are in a very conservative stature right now, meaning we're not pedal to the metal, all equity.
And this week, I should mention, as I start this out, by the way, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava are going to do the big picture on the program. They're going to discuss what you're discussing here in more detail. So that'll be coming up in the second hour of the program. And sharing some of the subject material from Chris's quarterly newsletter. So you said it was a mixed bag. I mean, I'm assuming it wasn't all dire, since obviously we rallied, right? So what were some of the growth drivers and earnings this week?
Right. Actually, before we go there, it wasn't just industrials that had some negative reactions. Alphabet, they blew away earnings, but then we saw the stock react negatively towards those. We've seen that in financials basically almost for the past, almost the whole season. Not all of them, of course. And then with that weakness in Alphabet stock, that carried some of the big name FANG stocks down, like Facebook and Netflix. And another name in global growth was Freeport-McMoRan. They dropped around 14.5% on earnings, with a disappointment in earnings and revenue. Obviously, some of that is still based on some of their continued problems in Indonesia. But yes, we did rally strongly on Wednesday from intraday lows, and then again on Thursday with some follow-through based on strength in Boeing, Texas Instruments, Anthem, Norfolk Southern, Facebook, Visa, and Advanced Micro. So not to mention the huge shocker, Chipotle, which finally beat consensus on same stores growth. Very huge reaction in the stock there. If you combine some of the consumer discretionary stocks with Chipotle and many others, consumer discretionary had probably the best week out of the group. So, but overall, we've seen probably 53% of the S&P 500 reported so far. Of that, 79% have reported earnings per share above estimates. And that's the highest FactSet has recorded since tracking this data back in the third quarter of 2008. So all sectors reporting growth. And of those, the ones that are showing the double-digit growth has been led by energy, materials, information technology, and financials. But technology, we're seeing investors fade these results. Same thing with financials, where we've seen a lot of concerns about loan growth.
And, you know, it seems like the theme with investors has been that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I mean, you'd think with maybe higher guidance towards the annual outlook, even for companies like Caterpillar, would have been rewarded. And I thought it was, you know, with a higher open for the stock before the conference call, set the price lower. It's very interesting times, so there's no doubt about that. Was there anything else you wanted to focus on this week besides earnings? I mean, were there any other drivers you'd like to talk about? How's the market? How's it reacting to some of the recent economic news?
Well, on the economic news, the big print was really on Friday. We got the first estimates for Q1. GDP printed lower than the final GDP print on Q4. But do remember that Q4 had been revised higher a number of times. Could be the low point. Maybe it gets revised higher. I don't know. We see how these things kind of play out over the course of a few months. However, the main thing is, how did the market react to this news? We did see yields drop a little bit. And again, that ties into maybe some concerns about growth that we saw from Caterpillar's earnings. The durable goods order was up 2.6% for March, John, but it was actually a little misleading, since if you dig into the number, if you exclude orders for aircraft and defense, it was actually down 0.1%. And the shipments for those non-defense and non-aircraft goods was down 0.7%. So again, you got to dig deeper into some of these numbers. The headline number doesn't tell the whole story. Housing had a decent week, but low supply continues to constrain sales. But overall, new home sales, pretty strong number, came at an annual rate of 694,000, which was well above consensus, which I believe was around like 660 something thousand. So it was a good beat. The only other thing that I'd mention is traders all week, there was a lot of focus on the 10-year yield. We talked about it last week. We were coming up on testing on 3. We broke above 3 this week. And that was beginning to lead into some concerns that, hey, higher interest rates eventually at some point is going to cut off liquidity and cut off loan growth. It's going to eventually cut off housing, higher mortgage rates, and less affordability, considering that the home prices keep going up each year. That's been a concern. So looking at interest rates, they did drop towards the end of the week on that GDP figure. And we did see a big jump in REITs due to the reaction on Friday. And finally, John, we did get some central bank action this week. European Central Bank, they left rates unchanged, flat. And then I believe they're still buying bonds at a 30 billion euro rate until September. And then Asia Bank of Japan also left interest rates unchanged. So that was actually as expected. So no real news there. And it didn't really move the market too much, but just to let our listeners know.
Good show. Look forward to hearing the interview, or more of a discussion, really, between Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan, talking about your anticipatory indicators, because I know that's something Jim's always talking about as well. Anything else, or are we closing out for the week?
That should do it. It's great weather here. I don't know how things are going for you over there, but I'm looking forward to this weekend. And then next week, going to be another busy week on earnings. So not as busy, I think, as this week. But, you know, it's nice, though, John, every now and then where we get to talk about companies and not just the macro moving the market.
Yeah, exactly. No, it truly, truly is. All right, Ryan Poplava, appreciate it. And obviously, we will have fodder for folderol next week, right?
You got it.
You know what everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something not everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
There's a broad question over whether the United States is willing to consider working with Russia in fighting against the Islamic State and other VEOs, and whether it's willing to work more with Turkey in fighting the Islamic State and other VEOs. And a U.S. withdrawal from Syria would be very beneficial to Russia's aims in the Middle East, and it would be very beneficial to Turkey's aims in the Middle East. So those great powers would actually be quite happy with the U.S. withdrawal from Syria, even though there are many other regional allies that would not be happy with the U.S. withdrawal. So I think that the United States is trying to weigh all of these different things, and I think that's been the reason for some of the confusion, is that there's no clear answer for what is the best course forward for the United States.
Well, the 10-year yield is finally broken out above 3%. Only a week ago, we were talking about a flattening yield curve and the possibility of inversion. What does all this mean? Joining me on the program is market strategist John Roque.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me. So here goes. So over the past several months, it was said or distributed in across the media and across CNBC that technology's relative market cap weighting in the S&P 500 was 25.5%. And that was generally true, but I didn't think it was the right number because There are three big tech stocks, as I referenced them, that are included in the consumer discretionary sector. Those tech stocks are Amazon, Booking Holdings, which is the former Priceline, and Netflix. And together, that comprises more than $1 trillion in market cap. So then I took that weighting out of consumer discretionary, and I added it to tech. And then that weighting for tech took tech from 25.5% to 32%+, and the all-time high for tech in 2000 was just over 33%. So I said, wait a second, people aren't really looking at this correctly. And then I adjusted the financials market cap, and I added back real estate to financials because that's the way the S&P used to provide it. And when you add both of them together, as of mid-March, the adjusted relative market cap for financials plus tech was 50% of the S&P, which is the highest ever. And so I sort of explained it here, and I said, you know, if a portfolio manager had 50% of the weightings in his portfolio in two stocks, he'd be pretty darn concerned. And I think people have been a little bit cavalier about the risks posed by the two biggest sectors, financials and tech. So that's the way I'm looking at it here. And I thought that the adjusted relative market cap told a better story and a more complete story than did the one that was being popularized in the media.
Yeah, because when I think of technology, I think of Amazon as tech versus, let's say, consumer discretionary. I want to go to the next chart, which is energy market cap as a percent of the S&P, looking like it's almost down to almost record levels that we haven't seen going back to the late 90s.
Yeah, so you said it correctly. This is a support area for the market cap weight, relative market cap weight of energy as compared to the S&P 500. It stayed down here for a long time from the late 90s, you know, 98 into 99 and all the way into 2004 before it really started accelerating upward. There's no way for me to tell if this is going to make a big turn up, but I figure at this level, the energy group should have some market cap support compared to some of the other sectors. And especially given what I just told you about tech, it would seem to me that it would have some support relative to tech at the very least.
Yeah, it's in contrast to its market cap weighting, which is, what do you have here, around roughly between 5 and 6% versus the other two groups.
Yeah, let's call it 5.5%, which would give us a good idea.
Okay, I want to move on to the next one, which has a lot of relevance here, and that's the 2-year yield to the 10-year yield. There was concern that the yield curve was flattening, John, that we were in the possibility of an inversion, but now we've had some long-term rates break out. So let's talk about this chart, 2-year yields to 10-year yield. What is that telling you?
Well, I just wanted to make it clear to myself as to what prior cycles have looked like. And I realize that there's a tremendous outlier here and that the ratio for twos to tens got to be a very low figure, as you could see at the bottom of the chart. But I did this because I wanted to see what the prior cycle highs were and what they looked like for this ratio. And in the late 70s, early 1980 period, again in the late 80s, and in the late 90s, and again in the 2006 period, the ratio got to be just above one. So I took a look at this, and I'm just wondering, could this mean that the yield curve has further to go or further to flatten in this regard? But that doesn't mean the 10-year is not going to rally because of its breakout. But I just thought, let me take a look and see what this shows me on a historical basis, because I wanted to make sure what had happened in prior cycles.
You know, your next chart, which is the 2-year yield, I find rather interesting because the upper chart you have, it's hard to believe, and I think people have forgotten how far we've come. In the summer of 2016, when we saw yields really get low, the 2-year was at 0.5% compared to today where it's over 2%. So let's talk about that. I mean, that's quite an upward move in just a short period of time.
Yeah, so my line here has been, two can get you four, meaning the 2-year yield can get you to 4%. That sort of was a long-term target. And now because the 2-year is where it is, it seems to me that, you know, we've had a tremendous acceleration. But it's not crazy to me to think that this could ultimately get to near 4%. And, you know, we have some other charts in here, and we could take a look at those just to see what those long-term bottoms and acceleration moves look like as well.
Yeah, your next chart, you're talking about the 5-year yield, which is approaching 3%. And looking at the chart, there's a possibility it could head to 5.
Yeah, so my initial target for the 5-year yield for some time has been 3%. And again, you know, I just said, well, if things really get crazy on the upside, could this get to 5%? It could be a crazy number, but certainly the yield increase or the yield, the rate of change or the ascent of the move has been so fast of late, it wouldn't surprise me if it overshot dramatically to the upside.
So we've got the 5-year. Now let's talk about the 10-year. And for a lot of individuals who are out there trying to, let's say, buy a home for the first time, a lot of these mortgages are tied to the 10-year yield. And this one is rather interesting, especially on the day you and I are speaking, with the 10-year breaking out above 3%. So let's talk about this significance of going over 3 and where you think this might be heading.
Well, so the chart insert shows the daily prices for the 10-year yield going back to 2011, and you can see that I have a horizontal line at the bottom and a dashed line at the top, and the height of that base, so to speak, is 150 basis points, and if you add it to 3%, you get to a 4.5% figure. The 4% target in the bigger picture was something that I had set up some time ago, and I just left it in there because I wanted to be honest to what I had put in before. But I think the long-term chart is just, it's one of those classic charts that if I had a corkboard near my desk, I'd have it pinned to it. So the data goes back to 1790, and I've tried to go through all sorts of cycles for the 10-year Treasury yield to see if there was some uniformity. And as you can see, and as the listeners, if they want to look at the charts, can see there's really no uniformity. I also think it was pretty darn cool that in 1945, you bottomed at 1.55%, and then in July 2012, it was at 1.51%. So I call that a 67-year double bottom, and then you made a slight undercut low in 2016. I wonder if that's the all-time record for double bottoms at 67 years. But you have the breakout above 3%. Again, the height of the base is 150 basis points, and if you just add it onto the breakout level, that gets you to 4.5%.
You know, John, do you think this market can handle 4.5% without having some significant damage to all the major indexes, and especially some of those stocks that we talked about that are overpriced, especially in the technology area where you have, you know, stocks like Amazon that are selling at multiples that, you know, harken back to the technology bubble?
Well, I'm going to ask you a question without being a wise guy. Do algorithms care what the rate is on the 10-year?
Probably not.
I'm being facetious. I don't know what the figure is on the 10-year that's going to present a problem for the S&P or for stocks broadly. I don't know what the number is. I just don't know, and I don't know if there's any way to tell. I know that 85% of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange is passive related, so I don't necessarily know if the people who have continue to use passive vehicles care about what the rate is. Perhaps they do. I'm not certain. I don't know. I think we have to take it one step at a time. And given the way, you know, markets can sort of present clues, perhaps we'll be able to glean something from the price action.
You know, something I'd like to get your comment on, and this was something that I discovered early last year when I started looking at some of these stocks, especially the FANG stocks. And I looked at Amazon and I said to myself, who would be paying 250 times earnings for a stock like that? But then when I looked at who were the top 10 holders, they were all index funds. I wonder if you might comment of the role that algo trading in indexing is playing in this market today.
I'm going to answer you as honestly as possible. I don't have a great answer for you. I don't know, and I don't think that anybody really does know. I do know that over time, I've looked at the top 10 stocks in each market globally and have seen how their weightings in their respective indexes have grown and have grown tremendously. I can only guess as to what the effects are. I can measure it, I believe, on a daily basis by looking at the market internals, but I really don't have a great handle on what sort of effects it has produced on the upside. I will say with some certainty, though, that nobody knows what the effects could be on the downside if there is a sell-off. We're only comfortable with the way it works on the upside.
Well, maybe we got a little glimpse of that in that little correction that happened in 6 days beginning at the end of January, which brings me to your next chart. It's one of the S&P 500 and the weekly MACD. In your comment, this was the greatest weekly overbought reading of all time. Let's discuss that.
Okay, now I realize a lot of the what is reflected here has to do with the price level of the S&P 500 and its moving averages. So it's not a percentage MACD, it's an absolute MACD. Be that as it may, as the chart shows, that was the greatest weekly overbought reading of all time. going back in perpetuity. However, I think all momentum indicators pre-1994 really don't reflect what's gone on in these cycles, because I think from 1994 forward, we've had mostly price cycles or central bank cycles, and they have eliminated, for the most part, or to a great degree, economic cycles. But that's a call for a different day. And it's my take here that because we've had the greatest weekly overbought reading of all time, we're going to have to, at the very least, get to an oversold reading, or to at least, again, a negative reading for this weekly MACD. You can see that if we go back to the late 90s, when you've had other overbought readings at the dashed trend line, the horizontal dashed line, when you've come off of there, you have at least gotten to negative territory. And when you've had real declines, like you had in 99, 2000, and into the 02 low, and as you had in 07, 08, and into the early 09 low, and again in 2011 and 15, you got to some measure of negative readings on this weekly MACD. Even if you got only to the 2015 levels, you'd have to come down a lot further than you are here. So it's not necessarily that I'm interpreting the chart as to where it must go. I'm just looking at the history of it and figure where it went to before, and if it's likely being used in the same fashion, shouldn't we get to some measure of oversold reading this time as well?
In your next chart, which is the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index with a momentum indicator, you know, I looked at this chart in the first chart that you showed of financials and tech, and this thing is higher than it was in the year 2000.
Yeah, so I've adjusted my index here for dividends. Some people will not adjust theirs for dividends, and curiously, the semiconductor index, now not adjusted for dividends, is right at or very close to what was the peak in 2000. But because mine's adjusted for dividends, it's higher as a result. So I sent this chart to you, and then after I sent this chart to you, I did a study. And so on this index, can I share the study with you?
Sure.
Okay, so here goes. So yesterday was the first time in 458 days that the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, or the SOX, closed below its 200-day moving average. The last time the SOX was beneath its 200-day moving average was back on May 13th, 2016. So the 458-day streak was an all-time record for the SOX, and I used all daily data going back to May of 1994. That's when the SOX first started as an index. Now, there were prior consecutive day streaks for the SOX where it spent considerable time above its own 200-day moving average. While yesterday ended the all-time record at 458 days, there were other long streaks. I'll read them to you here. 447 days, 441, 265, 249, 236, and 157 days. And, of course, I did that in descending order. But from the first one, Jim, all the way through the sixth one, and again, there are six prior cycles, when the SOX broke its 200-day moving average, it was already in the midst of a corrective phase. So there's no way for me to extrapolate the past into the future. I'm only using the weight of the evidence to say that when we have had other streaks of great length where the SOX has spent a considerable amount of time above its 200-day moving average, and that streak was broken, the SOX was already in the midst of an important decline. Now, I'll read you the declines. This is not a forecast. Okay, so from the middle of September of 1995 until the end of July of 1996, about 45 weeks long, the SOX declined 54%. For 59 weeks, from the end of August of 97 through the early part of October of 98, the SOX declined 55%. And then we all know about the March 2000 through the October 02 decline, which was 134 weeks. The SOX was down 85%. The fourth one lasted 34 weeks from mid-January 2004 through right around mid-September 2004, down 37%. The fifth one lasted only 20 weeks, mid-May 2010 through early September 2010, down 24%. And then the sixth one was a little screwy. You had a first corrective phase, and then you made a push to a new reaction high, and then there was a 28% decline over 12 weeks from early June 2015 through late August 2015. So these are the down cycles or down legs for the SOX once it had broken an extensive streak above its 200-day moving average. So I'm not forecasting that this is what is likely to happen. I'm telling you what we might want to be prepared for if history is any guide.
Well, this takes us to the next chart where you're showing the S&P Infotech with 200-day moving average. You know, this is sort of supportive of what you're seeing in the stocks.
Well, again, so we've had two declines this year. We were down 12% and down 11%, and the index hasn't even gotten to its 200-day moving average. And Jim, I'm old enough to remember that in the 90s, even when we, you know, had a great bull market from 1994 all the way to 2000, nearly all stocks got to their 200-day moving average on a calendar year basis. It's almost inconceivable that we could spend so long above the 200-day moving average. Now, some people might like 150 days. Some people might like some other permutation, but I'm just going to stick with the 200. So I don't think it's that crazy a call or an estimation or to believe that we should get underneath there. And I think getting underneath there would create a very good oversold reading. And so I boxed the chart, the early part of the chart, to show that the last time the technology sector went through a rough period, it lasted about a year. You had three declines, almost 17%, almost 17%, and just about 9%. So it would not be crazy to me to think that because we had such a great move and because some of the indicators were so extended that we'd have to go through a period of, at the very least, sideways action for these great overbought readings to be ameliorated.
In the final chart, which is the VIX, which got down to, I think in the beginning of the year, got down to a record low at 9. What is this telling you? Because certainly we've seen a lot more volatility come into the market since that first correction that began in January.
We certainly have. And so the chart here goes back to January 1986. And your listeners should know that, of course, there was no VIX in 1986 or at the spike high in 1987. It was created synthetically, but it seems to work. And I continued to maintain the data. And all I did was take a look at where prior spike highs for the VIX have occurred and what would be correspondingly prior spike lows for the S&P 500, and you could see that at three standard deviation levels since 1990, most spike highs get to just above the 40 level on the VIX. So it would not surprise me if the VIX spiked once again and got above where we were just a few weeks ago and got just above the 40 level.
You know, in conclusion, as you look at this, John, we're seeing large capitalization weighting of financials and tech. We're seeing valuations, quite honestly, we haven't seen since going back to the bursting of the tech bubble. I mean, on the day you and I are speaking, Amazon has got a market value of almost $708 billion, selling at almost 237 times earnings. This harkens back to that period of time when you saw these kind of valuations. And if you take a look at how money's going into the market, I don't think anybody's asking questions. They're just buying.
Well, a few short weeks ago, or let's call it, you know, sometime in February, I took a look, and I believe I have this in my memory, that if you took the market cap for Apple and Google, it was greater than the entire market cap for the DAX index in Germany, the dollar market cap. So I converted the DAX, you know, euro market cap into a dollar market cap, and Apple and Google's combined market cap was bigger than that for the DAX. You know, some of these comparisons are quite extraordinary, and if, you know, you've been around long enough, then you tend to put them in historical context, and the historical context that you're using, which I don't think is all that crazy from a price perspective, is what we saw when we went from 1999 into 2000. Now, the bulls would tell you that the earnings are so much better than they are now than they were then, and stocks are cheaper, and I believe that because they are cheaper, but it doesn't mean that you don't have momentum excesses at the same time.
Mm. So in summing this up, John, given what you're seeing right now, would you say you're neutral, you're cautious, bullish? What would you be doing if you were an investor?
I'd say that I think it's right to be cautious here. And I think you've heard the same thing from a guy like Howard Marks, who is a value investor. I don't think it's that crazy to adopt a cautious or a more cautious viewpoint here.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Well, John, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and sharing your insights with these charts with our listeners. Thank you so much and have yourself a great weekend.
You too, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Oil has transformed the Middle East from a piece of desert to the center of one of the most strategic resources in the world. But all of that is changing. Jim's guest coming up next is Dr. Ellen Wald, author of Saudi Incorporated, The Arabian Kingdom's Pursuit of Profit and Power, talking about how Saudi Arabia's goal is to retool their economy away from a dependency on oil to high-tech manufacturing. Saudi Aramco, their IPO, and the end of the age as Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.